Blog Talk Radio.
That's right, everybody. You know who it is. Coach Mike Jones on the coach with the most. Coming at you hard from coast to coast. I don't want to boast, but now I got to roast you in my social media posts. You double dose, or diagnose. You feeling tired, life expired, now you're a ghost. I'll be your host, so won't you raise a toast to the coach with the most, Coach Mike Jones.
Welcome to another edition of the Coach Mike Jones Show podcast, episode 43, with myself and Sign Guy. He's so fly. He's going to make you high. He's going to make you feel like you're in the sky. And I don't have to lie, because he might even be better than baseball, hot dogs, and apple pie. Sign Guy, how you doing?
I'm doing okay today, Coach, with the most coming out from coast to coast. You don't mean to brag, but you have to boast, because your favorite all-time baseball player is, of course, Hall of Famer Ned Yost.
He sure is. Nice. So I hear you got a sign of the times coming up here shortly.
Well, I'm at an undisclosed park, which is extremely hard to find. Old Kim Hamlin and Tanya are nearby, from my understanding. That's what I've been told here at this undisclosed park. It's a hard one to find.
Okay.
Hard one to find. All right. It was so undisclosed, I almost didn't make it.
Right on. Well, it looks like our guest is called in. Is this Cue Ball Carmichael? How you doing?
Hey, Coach, how are you?
I'm doing great. I'm here with Sign Guy today. You guys are really familiar with each other, he told me. You guys used to be on shows together, so we got Sign Guy with us.
What's up, Sign Guy?
It's been a long time, Cue Ball. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. Good to talk to you again.
Absolutely.
All right, Sign, start us off with the first-timer question.
Okay, well, I know this one very well, Cue Ball Carmichael, so forgive me for asking something you've answered before, but since you're the first time here with Coach, how did you get into this crazy business of professional wrestling?
Wow, that's an interesting story. I knew when I was nine I was going to be in the wrestling business. I was born and raised in upstate New York, and when I was nine, I heard my mother screaming from the living room, and she's yelling for my dad to run in there, and I think somebody's broken into the house, and wrestling was on TV, and she goes to my dad, do something, this guy's killing him, and Freddie Blassie is jabbing a pencil in some guy's head. He was bleeding all over the place. And I looked at my mom. I looked at the TV. And it could have been underwater Himalayan folk dancing, roller derby, or wrestling. But whatever I was going to be able to do to put people on a roller coaster, I was going to do. So really the next 12 years of my life was dedicated to finding a school to go to and making enough money to go there. And, you know, back in 82 when I left to go to Hawaii from upstate New York to train, you know, way before the internet, way before cell phones, even before pagers, and dropped everything, sold everything I owned, moved to Honolulu, rented a room, went over to Lars Anderson. He refused to train me. went to Samoans. They refused to train. He went back to Lars Anderson. He refused, went back to the Samoans, and they finally said, okay. And that started my journey in pro wrestling. So, you know, back then there was really three schools. There was the Hearts of Calgary. There was Vern Gagne had one in Minnesota. And I'm looking at these places that are just as cold as upstate New York where I'm from. And then I find my VIA school, Pilatum Settlement Gym in Hawaii. So I made a decision I was going to go to a warmer climate and learn to wrestle there. So that's really what happened. But I got addicted when I was 9. I used to sneak down and watch the old WWF Midnights on Saturday on Channel 11 out of New York. And, you know, just started going to local wrestling shows at Broome County Arena. And finally got a job when I was like 20 in security. And got to meet Andre the Giant, Jimmy Snuka, and Bob Backlund. And all these guys just wanted to do it from the time I was 9. So that's how I embarked on my journey. Of course, I was in Hawaii for 4 years, wrestled there, moved back to Connecticut, nothing going on there. Moved to Virginia. I was about 5 years in the business. And I felt like, you know, really all I got trained to do. I had a great trainer in Steve Offey and a few of the other Samoan guys, but it was more of a brawling type wrestling. So in 88, after 5 years in the business, I got old Lou Fez in Norfolk, Virginia, at the Wrestling Academy. I went down there. You know, Lou was very formal. I had to go down and meet him for an interview before he would decide whether he was going to take me. So I went down to Sport Coat and Tie, and I met him. And he says, well, I'll let you know. And about a week later, I get a letter in the mail that he's inviting me to attend his Wrestling Academy in Norfolk. So went there for about 10 months with Lou Fez. And, you know, that was like torture wasn't enough in Hawaii where I got, you know, in those days they beat the hell out of you for 6 weeks. And if you didn't go away, they smartened you up. Well, they didn't smarten you up until they beat the hell out of you, because if you left, then you'd tell everybody, oh, no, that shit's for real, right? So made it through that, and then I went to Lou Fez's, and Lou was a taskmaster and ran us every day. And I'm telling you, for the first month, I puked every single day. So, but that's how I got into it. It took off from there and started getting more popular in independence in the Mid-Atlantic area, lived in Virginia, the 4-hour drive to Pittsburgh, 4-hour drive to Raleigh, 3 hours to New York, 5 hours to Boston. So I just started, you know, traveling, and the popularity started to grow a little bit. Hooked up with Tom Brandy in the early 90s, 94, 95, and started wrestling him, and Tom put a good word in for me everywhere else and spread out. And when he went to the WWE in 96, Salvatore Sincere, he got us in up there. I was up there from 96 to about 2000. And that's just kind of how it happened. Everything's from there.
Nice. Okay. So who were some of your heroes growing up, whether it was sports, music, wrestling, or ordinary life, or all the above?
Well, my first hero, really, I've got an older brother who's 12 years older than me, and he went into Marines when I was 6 years old. He was 5 years old. He was 17. My mom signed for him, became a lifer in the Marine Corps. So, you know, he'd come home and spend a month at home, and he'd show up and attack me out front, get out in his dress blues and his sea bag and come in. So that was really the only hero I really ever had until I started following wrestling in the 70s. And then, of course, it was superstar Billy Graham. I mean, he was so colorful and so funny and, you know, just built so well. And, you know, those days you don't know somebody that can really work, or somebody who just gets in there and gets the attention and so superstar Billy Graham was. I liked Bruno Sammartino, but I was more for the colorful, flamboyant type heel guy. So superstar Billy Graham was really like my first guy I discovered that I like. Wow, I'd like to be like him.
And what about in sports and music?
Sports, really. I mean, my dad was a Dallas Cowboys fan, so I had to pick somebody opposite, so I picked the Philadelphia Eagles because they played the Cowboys a couple times a year. And hockey, I like the Philadelphia Flyers. I went to a lot of concerts. I saw, you know, everybody from REO Speedwagon 2 or 3 times. I've seen Springsteen about 5 or 6. Just a ZZ Top, a bunch of concerts. in like the 70s and 80s and 90s. I went to a big one at Aloha Stadium in 85. It was Cheap Trick. It was Aerosmith getting back together. REO Speedwagon, The Police. I mean, just huge, huge tour. So I was, I always liked going to concerts. In
and then,
sports, really no one guy.
Okay. And then what about, I'm sure Sign Guy and the fans would like to know what your favorite coffee to drink is.
Not really a coffee drinker, man.
Okay, I buy
Steve Carino's Squared Circle coffee, and I put that in my Keurig stuff. But like, I've never been much of a coffee guy. I was for a long time, and I always drank. You know, around here, there's no real independent coffee shops in the East Coast like there is out on the West Coast or Washington. Big fan of Dutch Brothers. But they don't have that over here, so it's used to be Starbucks, you know. Nothing like paying $11 for a $4 drink.
Oh, yeah. All right, awesome. Sign?
Well, Q-Ball, of course, we were co-hosts together on the Undisputed Wrestling Show, and you got to interview a lot of people on that show over the time you were there. What would you say was there that you learned your time at the Undisputed Wrestling Show?
I think it was the night that we had Bob Holly on, and I told Bob what a dick he was to me at the WWE, and instead of being a jerk about it, he was like, hey, man, look, I was up there. I was on the bubble every time a new guy came on board. You know, I worried about me being axed next, and I'm not really like that, and I'm a welder now. My life's much happier, and really explained, you know, the stigma about him just not being a very friendly guy, and came off on the show as like this big baby face. And I was stunned by that. Of course, we did Dance 5-2, which is kind of cool. I asked him if he was getting any overrides from Waylon Murphy's gimmick, Waylon Mercy. And, you know, but I think really my two favorites at the time I was there was Holly and definitely Dan Spivey.
Okay. And
well,
then,
we had a lot of great guests on that show, man.
Did you play sports in high school or growing up?
Yeah, I did growing up my whole life. I played football. I wrestled. I played baseball. I was really good at baseball. Didn't have my interest. About 11th grade in high school, I didn't really play any more high school sports because I got a couple of jobs. And I enjoyed having the car, paying the insurance, and having a motorcycle and a snowmobile and money. And so once I discovered real jobs, that was really took over for sports. I did play two years of semi-pro football in Binghamton, New York, for the Binghamton Jets, back 80, 81. So, but that kind of worked out for me because that's how I got the job at Broome County Arena as security. And I had an old enhancement guy wrestled as Bimbo Larson. And he set up the ring for the WWWF. And he got me in there and bounced me around a little bit and showed me some stuff and said, hey, kid, you actually got sort of a talent for this. You should go to wrestling school. And I'm like, they have those? And so he was the one that really hooked me up with going out to my VIA school in Honolulu. So, you know, that was sort of like an I wanted to do it anyway, but you really, you know, when you don't know how, and you only hear of three schools, and back then without internet, without knowing somebody, and it was a weird day, right? When I tried to buy my wrestling boots, there was one place, B-Barn-A, Old Mole used to make the boots. You trace your feet on a paper and send it out to him, send him money, but he wouldn't sell you the boots until you talked to who trained you. And K&H out in Ohio, K&H Wrestling Wear, they wouldn't build you a singlet until they called Lou Bez. You know, and confirmed that I'd spent some time with him and was ready to go. It was just, you know, the business was so well protected back then. It was just really difficult.
Okay,
of course it was,
and then
you know.
I want to thank you first for what you've done for wrestling and stuff like that. But more importantly, you're now a police officer, so I want to thank you for your service there. And then tell the people about your self-defense background.
Really, you know, my big self-defense background was I took karate. First I learned to box. And I was fortunate enough to work for a guy that had been a top 10 contender in light heavyweight division in the 60s. He was boxing, and he showed me how to box. And then I took American Kick Punch Karate Federation. I went through there and went all the way up to brown belt. But really the biggest self-defense training I had was Lou Thesz, who, you know, back him, his books are titled Hooker, right? You know, I try to tell people, Hooker, I'm talking about your sister who works on a street corner. I'm talking about a guy who takes a shooter and the shooter shoots in for a double leg and the hooker breaks his elbow. You know what I mean? So that was the biggest. Lou was still was training. He just got done training Masahiro Chono. He had another kid there while I was there. Who just, I moved to California and gave up. I don't fell in love probably. But Lou definitely thought he trained you how to protect yourself. He said, there's going to be a point in every match where you want that guy to know that if this was a shoot, he wouldn't stand a chance. And so Lou was real strict about knowing how to take care of yourself. But he came from an era where, you know, the NWA champion wrestled in different territories. And they would have a guy come in that was supposed to be a tough guy. And they're like, just take the title off. Because if you take it off him in the Chicago territory, the belt's going to stay here. And, you know, they couldn't do it. They couldn't take it off him. So, you know, he was real big on that. I know that in the 80s, the territories were disappearing really fast. But he was still big on training guys to take care of themselves. So,
right on. Was,
yeah. That was probably the best self-defense training I ever had.
Well, Cuba, one of the things you worked on a few years ago was you were looking to try to help wrestlers get health coverage at sort of a unified front across the board at all the levels of wrestling. I don't know that it ever fully got established, but what was the goal you had in mind and what became of that?
Well, the whole goal was to try to unionize on every level, whether it was a promoter, a wrestler, a ring crew guy, anybody else. And the deal was to try to get, you know, at least 500 people interested and get a national group health policy where we had enough people to keep the dues really, really low. And we need about 500, you know. And I pushed this thing for months and months and months and months and months and months. And the overall interest seems huge. Everybody wanted to do it. So I was able to say, look, for $39.95 a year, you can get in here. I can get you. I'm not going to be able to get you free doctor's visits and stuff like that, but I can get you, you know, basically a major medical catastrophe policy where up to $5,000, you're responsible for 20%. Above $5,000, they pay 100%. There'd be discount prescriptions and discount office visits if you go to the in-network providers. And literally, I had 18 guys in the whole world of wrestling sign up for it. And once I realized it was going to go any further than that, I just refunded everybody's money because it was just, you know, it seemed like it was a huge interest. And I talked to a lot of people before I even considered doing it. But the difference in the interest in somebody, you know, paying $40 and actually being in on it and have not just that, but, you know, if you look at the height of like independent wrestling, obviously not territorial wrestling, not where there's a circuit set up like there was in the 90s. But you look at around 2010, 2012, there are a lot of guys still wrestling independent shows across the country. And I tried to get a grassroots organization of these guys to start this. And literally less than 20 people signed up. And so I just refunded everybody's money. You know, I had Al Snow sign up. I had, you know, independent wrestlers from Pennsylvania sign up. But really, it was just, I was extremely disappointed because it generated a lot of talk, but not a lot of action. You know, the old saying is, right, everybody loves your stuff until they have to pay for it. You know, I've done four wrestling camps, and you know, Mike, I've done four different wrestling camps, and you know, they're not cheap. They were so successful that I would have other people who knew me, who were in the wrestling business, who couldn't make the camp, actually pay for somebody else to go. So all the person had to worry about was transportation to and from and getting a room, and the actual fee for their camp was paid for by a benefactor who, you know, the same. I had the same four or five guys do it, and they just didn't want to be recognized for it. They just wanted to do it. So, you know, I was able to give that free stuff to some people that might have made a difference, them coming to a camp and not going to a camp. And, you know, I had great guest trainers, Damian Wayne, Manny Fernandez. I mean, I had great people want to jump into camps and train with me and stuff and help out. And, you know, last one I did was 5 years ago when y'all came. And just, I haven't really done one since then, because it just doesn't seem, it's just weird. It doesn't seem to have the interest. Maybe the money's not there. I don't know. Maybe I've been around too long. Nobody knows who I am anymore. I don't know. I'd like to do another one, but I just don't know if that's going to happen either.
Yeah, dang. And like you were saying, $40 a year, my goodness, most people don't realize that a lot of unions, that's like a monthly due. So $40 a year would be nothing.
Yeah, it is a monthly thing. And, you know, this was been an annual fee, and that would have got everybody. Everybody would have had, if we got 500 people across the board, everybody would have had a major medical policy that prevented against catastrophes. Because how many wrestlers have we heard about that, you know, they end up on dialysis, or they get cancer, or they have diabetes, they lose a limb. Or, I mean, it's just so common, a major surgery. I mean, this would have covered all that for those guys for that $40 if we could have got 500 people to go in on this. And I can tell you, it took me a year to recover from that, because it was super disappointing that less than 20 people actually ended up and paid the fee.
Yeah,
and I'm
for
just
sure.
Just got a refund. I really thought there was more interest. And, hey, you know, I know for me, the whole entire time of my wrestling career, I'm fortunate enough where I've had a sales career. I've been an entrepreneur. I've owned 17 different businesses. I currently own two besides being a cop. And for me, I've always had that entrepreneurial spirit to make money, but I've also had jobs that provide benefits too for my family, because, you know, now, geez, there's so much insurance fraud in the United States today that the price of health insurance and car insurance is ridiculous because all the insurance fraud. You know, it's like,
yeah.
if you really need social service benefits, probably not going to get them. So the people that don't really need them, that work, they seem to be able to get them left and right. I mean, I do fraud investigations on people that have collected social services benefits for a year or two or three, and then they've been caught working at a job the whole time. For, you know, making $40,000 a year and just botching the paperwork. So if there was more fraud protection, it would be much cheaper for us to be insured. Or I hate to say it, if we had socialized medicine, but I don't agree with socialist countries, but I like socialized medicine.
I
was looking forward to having conversations. Are you sure this is safe, brother? Don't worry, I got that cue ball insurance.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Oh, no,
what happened.
My next question is a two-part question. The first part of it is, what's the most memorable matches you've seen?
I think one of the single best matches I've seen, the kind of memory I saw, the Briscoe brothers against Matt and Jeff Hardy on an Omega show, a tag team match. I was watching it with Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, so it had to be Omega's last run, 2015 or 16. It would have been a main event, pay-per-view, tag match anywhere in the world. It was just, the psychology was so incredibly good. It was just, I was just blown away at it. You know, it was crazy. And a lot of the Omega matches were really good. I've seen so many good matches over the years. I mean, what's going to take the biggest money match of all time? Andre and Hogan on that same WrestleMania You've got Steamboat and Sav. You know what I mean? I mean, it's just there's so many great matches I've seen. In person, I've seen so many good matches over the years. Most of them did not have me in them. But but I just think some really good matches, man. You know, I think my favorite was wrestling Dominic DiNucci in the sold-out Beaver Dome in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania for United States Championship Wrestling. We had Fox Television on Friday night with Bruno Sammartino calling the match. And when we played it back and listened to it, Bruno says, this other guy goes, "What do you think about cue ball, Bruno?" And he goes, "Cue ball? He's the dirtiest player in the game." I'm like, "All right, I could die and be happy." And the heel Bruno called me the dirtiest player in the game. I'm good.
Okay. And then, man, you've wrestled many legends and had a lot of great matches, but what are some of the most memorable matches you've been involved with?
I got to tell you, wrestling, Tom Brady and Jimmy Snuka teamed up against me and Cicero in Fort Dix, New Jersey. It was sort of when the Army base was active there, there had to be 6,000-7,000 people, and we had opposite heel face dressing rooms, so we never spoke a word, met in the ring. I started out with Snuka, never said a word, just did everything. Everything with Jimmy at that time, this is going back to 2002, 2003. I mean, he was just so flawless in the ring. He didn't need to say anything. You just knew what he was going to do. He knew what you were going to do. It was incredible. You know, really, really good match. And, you know, it was Jimmy. So, you know, I wrestled Beefcake one time on Tom Brady's show. This had to be 2008 or 9 and in Philadelphia, big house. And it was the same thing. He got in late. And he goes, "What do you want to do?" I said, "I don't know. I'll just call it to you in there." And he's like, "All right, let's go." So, you know, just really good, solid match. The same thing as with George Steele. I mean, I go, how am I putting you over? He goes, I'll pick you up in a hammerlock and tap out. I'm like, all right. You know, just simple stuff. The guys that wrestled for a living, I mean, I wrestled Bill Eady and Bundy a bunch of times. There's not a whole lot of talking going on. It's just like, you know, what's the finish? And, okay, we'll work it out from there. And, you know, it's funny because when I worked up north a lot in the 90s and the early part of the millennium, you would see guys in a locker room, and I mean really good guys, go through the entire match 4, 5, 6, 7 times. What they're going to do next. And I never bought into that because guess what? If you do that and the crowd's not biting on it, you don't know how to change it, right? You're stuck in there. The crowd looks like an oil painting of still life. And you're going through your moves you planned out in the back and nothing changes. So I've always, you know, for the last, 30 years, been a big fan of, let's get the finish, all right, and let's just start how we start, you know. It's just, don't need any more than that. Let's play it, listen to the crowd, and play the match according to the crowd. For me, it's a lot simpler. Plus, I had a guy, a real young guy, he's real successful now. I think he's in NXT. And this is 10, 12 years ago. I was going out to wrestle him, and he's, all right, let's do this, and he goes through everything, right? Right before we go out, I go, dude, I forgot everything you said. Just listen to me. It'll be all right. This kid turned white as his sheet going out there. I'm like, honestly, I forgot everything he said. So just listen to me. And he, it was the first time he ever had a match called in the ring. And he went in the back, and he was just like, gaga. So that's how it's done. I'm like, oh, my God. Yeah, that's how everybody else does it. You know.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that Steamboat and Macho had Steamboat's match down to the T, like 90 different spots, you know, you hear this side of it. My goodness. But what a blessing,
well,
yes.
That was, you know, Savage was like anal when it came to that, want everything down. And Steamboat could do it either way. But, you know, I guess he figured, all right, let's do it. But, yeah, they had everything down to every – man, I could never. I've had too many concussions. I could never remember that. I really couldn't.
Goodness, huh?
I'd be like, what's next? I would not know, man. Damian Wayne, when I was wrestling him a lot, he had the NWA National Championship and the NWA Dog Title. And I remember sitting in the locker room. Bruce Stark was there when he owned the NWA. And there was a bunch of big-name guys there in a locker room. Damon's on the other side. He goes, we're on main event. It's two or three matches into the show. He goes, do we need to talk about anything? I said, no, I'll put you over that big elbow off the top. That's it. The guys are looking, and it's coming down to, like, it's almost main event time. And one of the big-name guys, the NWA at the time, he goes, is that all you're going to say to him? I go, yeah, it's all I need to say to him, because I'm not going to remember anything else. So we're going to do it. And just went out, and the only thing we knew was the finish. And you tell him when to hit it. You know, I don't know, man. I can't remember that many things in order anymore. I can remember the finish, but anything else, I'm not going to remember. It's just not going to happen.
All right, fine.
Q-Ball, a lot of wrestlers in the last decade or so have been getting opportunities outside of North America. More independent wrestlers are able to go to Japan. Europe has opened up quite a bit. Some tours of South America have opened up. Australia has been a place for independent wrestling. As an independent, have you ever looked at going on tour outside of North America, or maybe even relocating to another place to try to open up a territory outside of the North American continent?
No, I'm pretty content to wrestle in the East Coast. You know, I've wrestled as far west as California. When I started Pacific Polynesian Pro Wrestling in Hawaii and Honolulu, we went to Guam, American Samoa, New Zealand, and Australia. So I got to wrestle in all those places when I first started. But for me, a lot of it was this, too, is always having either been a key player in a business or owned a business. I never really wanted to go. I went on a 13-day tour once. It was mostly started in Ohio, went to Minnesota, went up in Canada, went over to the Maritimes and came back. And when I got back home, I found out that six of my seven people had quit, and I had to start my business all over again. So for me, it was just one of those things where weekends, like a Friday, Saturday, Sunday was great. And even if we got Monday and Tuesday, we used to do the Raw on Monday, and Tuesday nights was the SmackDown tapings for Thursday night when I was with them. That was okay, but any more than three or four days during the week, if I was off, my business always fell to hell. So for me, I would have loved to go to Japan for months and made enough money to not have a business or not have to worry about anything but wrestling, but it just wasn't in the cards for me. But I'm glad the guys are getting the opportunity to travel. For me, it probably wouldn't have worked out as well having, you know, kids and having businesses or being a key player in a big business. It probably wouldn't have worked out great for me. It would have been nice to have the opportunity. But like I said, I got to go all through Pacific Polynesia, and that was nice and a lot of fun. And to be honest, if I had ever gotten full-time with the WWE, then you can make enough money to do, like, you know, they just went and they toured and they did Germany and the UK and all sorts of places like that. That'd be great. For the independent guys, you can make a rip. If you're an independent guy and you can make a living at wrestling and you get to tour, that's fantastic. That's a dream come true. There was just never enough money in it on the independent side to really make a living and be comfortable while I did it. So, but yeah, I mean, more power to them. If you're getting wrestling now and you got the you know, independent gigs that take you all over the world, I mean, go. If you don't have the commitment of kids and family and you can go see the world on somebody else's dime, hell yeah, go.
Okay, and then did you work any other, or did you do any different characters besides the Q-Ball Carmichael?
Yeah, I did. In the beginning, they listed me as Executioner number two. I wrestled a couple times as Dr. X under the hood. And so I came up with the cue ball gimmick, and then they let me take the lid off. But yeah, in the beginning, the very first match I had at NBC Arena, the promoter, Leah Maivia, was the promoter. She goes, what are you going to wrestle as? And I'm like, you know, I give her my shoot name. She goes, oh, my God. I'm like, what? She goes, hold on. She's back. She throws me a hood. She goes, put this on. I'm like, what? She goes, you're the executioner number two tonight. I'm like, why? She goes, Because nobody's going to pay to see Chris Jackson wrestle. Just not going to do it. We'd already have three of you.
Okay,
yeah. So I was like, oh, man. I had a bunch of my friends come down to see me. And I'm like, did you see me? They go, you didn't wrestle. I go, I was the guy in the mask who was in the first match. He's like, that wasn't you. I'm like, yes, well, that was right. They're like, no, it wasn't you. I go, I swear it was me. So I had to open up my gear bag and pull the mask out. And they're like, holy shit, that was you. You didn't sound the same. Well, you never sound the same when you put a hood over your face and you're yelling at people. It's always muffled. But, yeah,
yeah.
I did Super Japanese Machine number two. I did two for a while.
Okay.
So.
All right.
But
and then
most,
who was so your favorite in your opening match?
95% of my career was Cue Ball Carmichael.
Okay.
And thank God 99% of that was a heel.
What did you say, Sign?
I said he butchered kayfabe coming out of his first match there. Some of he was under the hood.
I did. I butchered it, man.
Okay, and then who are some of your favorite people to work?
I've got to say consistently. I love working Bundy because it was a big man, huge man match, but we put it together really well. We wrestled each other probably 25, 30 times. Tom Brandy was always one of my favorites. I wrestled Tom in seven different states and a bunch of different matches. You know, I only got to work with the Road Warriors once, but they were really easy and they sold a lot for us. So that was good. I think really Tom Brandy was my favorite guy. Now I've worked him as Johnny Gunn. I've worked him as Sal Sincere. I've worked him as Tom Brandy. So I've worked him as pretty much every name he's ever had. But that goes back 27 years. And we literally wrestle each other either in tag matches against each other or just singles matches against each other so many times. And it just, you know, I always tell everybody this, if you have a bad match with Tom Brandy, it's time to hang up your boots because the guy's just so good. And you know, for somebody that knew him as well as I did and wrestled him as many times, I mean, the matches were just really, really solid every time. And his favorite thing to do was I'd be him and me in the main event. He would go in and pigeonhole the promoter and have the promoter put him on right before intermission. He hit me with a big finish, 1, 2, 3. I'd roll out. Well, he ran to his gimmick table and opened up his gimmick table before anybody. And I would crawl back to the back, and he would sell gimmicks at the table right after a win. So it was so funny, but he sold a lot of gimmicks, man. It wasn't uncommon for him to come in the back and go, here, man, I made a lot. Here's $50. Thanks for helping me. I'm like, all right, thanks. Appreciate it. That's old school stuff right there. But, yeah, Tom and, you know, Julio De Niro, too. And Julio was Julio Sanchez, and then Hot Stuff Julio Sanchez. And then Sheik Ali Amin. And then finally, Julio De Niro. I've wrestled Julio probably more, I mean, as many times as I wrestled Tom, if not more. And we always had really good matches. So, you know, those are probably the two top guys for me because I wrestled so many. Bundy, Brandy, and Julio.
Sweet.
Yeah,
One of the things you've done in your career is a lot of tag team wrestling, and that's different than singles matches. There's a different mindset that goes into a little bit different skill set.
Sure.
Did you prefer one over the other?
Well, it's interesting. You know, when I first started doing tag team wrestling, I was fortunate enough. It was Cicero and me, and we were working the Bushwhackers a lot. So the great thing about it is we got immediate schooling from the Bushwhackers on how different psychologically tag team matches, right? Like, you know, a tag team match, totally different. You shove the guy in your corner if you're a heel. You get the ref's attention. You know, you drag him across the ring. You spit at the other guy. He comes in. The ref goes and gets him out of there because he spit on you and came in. Or you spit on him and he's coming in. And you go over, fake the tag, and then your other guy comes in. And, you know, just the different psychology. You know, the two most major things that I believe in wrestling is You should cheat where everybody can see it but the referee, right? Because if you job the ref, you job the match, you job the business. So you want to make sure you're always cheating where everybody can see it but the ref. So in tag team wrestling, totally different psychology. Absolutely. It's almost always the illegal man on the outside doing most of the helping when it comes to cheating, so getting the heat. So totally different. But, again, we had the Bushwhackers to learn from. So, you know, it's pretty easy for Jimmy and I the next 7 years to tag team. We wrestled the Pitbulls a lot, too, out of ECW. So those guys were really good tag teams. So, you know, we had school in the first 6 months or a year we were wrestling the Pitbulls and we were wrestling the Bushwhackers. So, yeah, at that time, there was no better tag team guys to learn from. So it was a pretty easy transition, but I think it was only an easy transition because these guys would sit down and explain why we do what we do in a tag match versus a singles match, and it made sense. But, yeah, they're two completely different animals.
Yes, for sure. And, man, speaking of teams, you've been part of some of the best, most talented factions in wrestling of all time, including the Fold. Can you tell the fans about some of the factions you've been in?
Yeah, you know, I was in TQM, me and Jimmy Cicero and Dino Devine and Chad Bellman and a couple other guys where we were in Maryland Championship Wrestling back when they would draw 1,700 people on a Thursday night at the Patapsco Arena, big houses, and we're in TQM, Total Quality Management. It was like a Tony Robbins gimmick group, right? Motivation, all this other stuff. And then the Fold is something I created down in Eastern North Carolina in around 2008 or 9. And it started to pick up steam. And when the promotion became an NWA promotion, we had the tag team belts. I won it once with Pat Cusick and won it once again with Sean Denny. And the Fold was, you know, basically consisted of Sean Denny, Pat Cusick, Lou Marconi, and myself. And then I took the Fold to Pennsylvania with just myself and Jimmy Cicero and his son Jack Cicero. And then a couple other guys we brought, like Mark Rivera, the Memphis Buffo, brought those guys into the Fold. So the Fold actually started North Carolina, but it went all the way up to Pittsburgh and lasted from 2008 all the way up to about 2017-18. And it was a pretty big faction. And I've been members of other groups, smaller groups, but I think TQM and the Fold were the biggest ones that had the most life and lasted the longest. And there was High Society in Pittsburgh. High Society in Pittsburgh was me and Cicero. Tom Brandy was in it, and one of the few times he was a heel up there for Steel City Wrestling. And High Society was a really good gimmick too in the Pittsburgh area. So, yeah, I've been fortunate. I've been in stables basically. Whenever we went into a tag team, we created an entire stable, a couple singles wrestlers, and usually it's a heavyweight, a junior heavyweight, and then a tag team. And most of the places we wrestled at, we ended up with all the titles. It just was a really strong heel clique, whether it was the Fold, High Society, or TQM.
Right on.
Yeah, blessed
now,
career for sure.
When you went out and were traveling around and you were doing factions like this, were you scouting talent at different shows that might fit into the factions, or did you leave that up to whoever was promoting?
Oh, no, absolutely. You know, I did most of the places I went. If I had something to do with the booking, and if I didn't, Tom Brandy would, and he would always consult me, and I would consult him. But, yeah, I mean, we just had – we always – I always scouted for the guys. I could just tell when a guy was going to be a good fit. If he was good in the ring, he had a little bit of pizzazz because, you know, you didn't have to be this overly charismatic guy because the group itself – adds charisma to the entire amount of people in it. So one of the best things, like in High Society, Cicero and I had brought in Mark Mess, who was a big dude, and we used his size and power. He wasn't being utilized very well. And so we brought him into it, and Tom Brady was just changing from a face to a heel, so we brought him into it. So, you know, when I did the fold down in North Carolina, they weren't really doing anything with Sean Denny. There was a light heavyweight category. I think Chase Owens had the title, and he's a contender. So I picked up Sean Denny, who's really charismatic, wrestled all the Tidewater area, and his brother Marky, who's the Georgia Bulldogs now. But, you know, I try to get somebody to fit. Like Lou Marconi was the flagship of the fold, as I called him. The basis of it was a tag team. And then we had a light heavyweight guy. And the same thing in High Society. We wanted a light heavyweight guy. We had Christian York in there. And we had the tag team of me and Cicero. We brought Mark Meston, and then we eventually brought Tom in. So it always consisted of four or five people. And, see, individually the pieces were pretty good. But synergistically, when we put them all together, it was a dominant force. So that was kind of the whole thing, is you go into this group and you have, you know, a guy or two that are really good, but then you take the other guys that the promotion just doesn't know what to do with, right? You see it on TV with Vince. Vince will have a guy that's great, but they don't know what to do with him, and he just gets lost in the mix. So it gave us a chance to find a guy that we weren't doing anything with. Promoter liked him, showed up every time he had a show. And what we do is just take those people and mix them into the fold or TQM or into the High Society or whatever we were doing at the time. So it gave our clique a lot of power, which is always good, but it made those guys so much more dangerous than they would be by themselves.
Okay, right on. And then you've wrestled a lot of the legends in wrestling and some of the toughest guys in wrestling. Who would you consider some of your toughest opponents you've been in the ring with?
Oh, my gosh. I think probably Hawk and Animal were pretty tough. I think May and Moolah were pretty tough. I wrestled those guys about a half a dozen times. Different kind of tough. But, you know, the guys are always tough that, like Ryan Mitchell, the Steel City Prodigy. He was really good, really tough. We had some vicious matches. Tom Brandy and I always had really physical matches. Not anybody gets hurt, but you knew you were in a match when you were done with that guy. And just as far as tough people go, I mean, Julio was tough because he wanted to do like 50 spots. Once he settled down, he wasn't so tough. He wanted to do 50 different things. But, yeah, Brandy probably, and Damian Wayne are probably the two toughest guys that I've wrestled a lot. Ryan Mitchell, I wrestled him three or four times. And that in 2016, it ended up with him going. He had been in the Navy when he was younger, was a pilot, got out, wrestled, got trained by Dory Funk Jr., had over 1,000 matches, went to my first ever pro wrestling camp I had in 2013, and him and I just clicked, and we just wanted to like work together. We got to in Pittsburgh, and after about 6 months of really physical matches, I mean, my neck had been fractured years ago, and it started bothering me again. And he got powerbombed in a match by Ryan Mitchell and me and broke his back. So he ends up going back in the Army as a warrant officer, and now he flies Black Hawk chopper pilots. And I forked off and went into law enforcement and became a cop. So it was kind of ironic that feud sort of chased both of us away wrestling. He got hurt really bad. And for me, at that point, it just wasn't that fun or interesting to me anymore because we had somewhere we wanted to go over a course of 2 years and kind of like stolen off from underneath us with the back broken and kind of disheartening to me. So I went and became a cop and he went and became a Black Hawk chopper pilot. Matter of fact, he just got home from deployment yesterday. So, you know, Brandy, I think Brandy, Damian Wayne, and Ryan Mitchell are the three toughest opponents I ever had.
Okay, definitely. And then, what an honor that you became a cop. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, you know, I'll say one thing: never make a deathbed promise to your favorite uncle, right? My uncle was a deputy sheriff, and he was my great uncle too. He was considerably older than me, and he was my grandmother's brother, but he was the youngest brother. So I would go spend weekends at his house. He was deputy in our home county, Cortland County, New York. Then he ran for sheriff and won with sheriff. Then he decided he wanted to go back to be a deputy. And so back then, you didn't really go through an academy to be a deputy sheriff. You rode along when the deputy felt comfortable, he'd sign off on you. So I would go and ride along with my uncle, and he always wanted me to be in law enforcement. And he ends up in the hospital. He's only in his early 60s. And he said, you got to promise me that at some point in your life, whenever all your ducks are in order, you'll get into law enforcement. I'm like, okay. But I go home and he dies. So that turns out being a deathbed promise to my uncle. So, you know, late in life, my early 50s, I started training to be a cop and, you know, go end up spending the last 7 or 8 years as a police officer. It was kind of funny because the sheriff's department sponsored me, but they all knew me. I had done a couple of benefits for sick officers and sick deputies and raised money. And they're like, are you ready to give up wrestling? I'm like, no, not really. They go, well, great. There's going to be plenty of it on the side of the road for you. So why don't you come let us pay your way through a basic law enforcement training? So I'm like, okay. So they sponsored me, and I went through it and got hired right away. And it was interesting, you know, I'm at the police academy. The average age is 21. I'm at the police academy at 56. So I'm 56, they're 21. And it was okay until the end of the class every day when we had to run 4 miles. And then I was like trying to tell the fitness instructor, wait a minute, I don't run 4 miles. I run 18 feet one way, hit a set of ropes, run 18 feet back, and then drop something. He's like, not tonight. So he just pushed the crowd, man. Lost like 50 pounds, really good lean running shape. And when I passed the POPAT, which is a police officer physical agility test, which is just a rapid fire run, jump, leap, push up, bam, 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 bam. A real big push to pass it physically. And I passed and he goes, okay, now I'm going to tell you a story. I'm like, okay. He goes, my dad was a cop. And we used to go to the old Dorton Arena in Raleigh. I'm like, okay. And he goes, I was 10 or 11 years old and I watched the matches. And one night I saw Wahoo McDaniel beat the living crap out of Ric Flair. I'm like, okay. And he goes, I'm with my dad out back and they're letting the wrestlers come out. And they're leaving, shouldered each other, laughing, joking, kidding around. And I go, oh, my God, they're friends. And it ruined my entire childhood fantasy of pro wrestling. So I finally got to take it out on somebody. I'm like, oh, my God. Did you tell me this like 5 months ago? He's like, yeah, no. So I got all his harbored anxiety for the previous 40 years of his life. So, but, you know,
hey, hold on a second. I know signs got to go pretty soon. How much more time do you got, Q?
I've got as long as you need me or about another 7 minutes.
Okay, then sign.
Sign later, buddy. Good talking to you.
Yeah, I have two. Always good to talk to you. A pleasure. Best of luck in all your endeavors, and hopefully we'll cross paths again sometime.
Same to you, and I hope so.
Okay. All right, and then now let's see. What are some suggestions you have for people wanting to get into the business?
My number one suggestion is to lift weights, run, get in great physical condition, and then go play football.
Okay. And then
suggestion is this. Live a clean life, right? Because, you know, if you have hopes of any type of hopes of going to AEW or going to WWE or anywhere like that, look, they go up. There's no polite way to say it. They go up your butt with a microscope, right? You can't have a DUI. You can't have an assault charge. You can't have any criminal history and get contracts with these people anymore. They just don't do it. They want squeaky, clean people. A lot of people have noticed, and a lot of young wrestlers take a little bit of umbrage with the fact that they go to other sports and get athletes, right? and they bring these athletes in and they teach them how to wrestle, because in their mentality, they can teach a monkey how to wrestle. But the problem is, if you've played college sports at any level, you don't have any type of criminal record, because they won't keep you in college, right? So
yeah,
they're looking for people who have no suspicious path whatsoever. So if you really want to be in wrestling, don't get stoned. I know it's a buzzkill, right? Don't drink and drive. Don't do the same stuff we did. We did none of that stuff wrong. And by say we, I mean me, you know? So you can't have any type of criminal history and get a deal with the WWE anymore. AEW is doing the same thing. You've got to really be, as a new athlete, you've got to be squeaky clean. So my suggestion is, if you're going to do it, take it seriously, that you eat right, you train right, you lift weights, you get in shape. And I know there's guys like Kevin Owens that are, you know, break the mold. But for the most part, look at the athletes on TV this day and age. They're the best athletes of any generation of pro wrestlers. It used to be in the 90s, it was bodybuilder big, right? Gotten away from that because of the moniker of steroids. So they're looking for lean, muscular, great athletes. So you've got to get into that if you're going to get a chance. And you got to keep your background clean, your history clean, no domestic. Look, for most people who are getting into wrestling, I would suggest doing what I didn't do. I didn't get married until I was in my 30s. I didn't have children until I was in my late 20s, because I wanted to be able to give pro wrestling a chance, an opportunity, and not have anything weigh me down. So, you know, don't become a father or a mother at 18, 19, 20 years old if wrestling is your goal, right? If wrestling is your goal, don't do that. Because, number one, when you have a child, you give up what? The right to be selfish. So you don't get the opportunity to go and just lift weights and just train and just go on the road and just wrestle. So you got to be a parent first. So my suggestion for everybody is, stay squeaky clean. When you do get married, plan out your family if you can, and just focus 5 years. If you're 20 years old, focus the next 5 years of your life to getting in killer shape and getting down and getting a tryout or getting a tape and getting it sent there, or just trying to get them to look at you, either way. But you really got to, these days, the dedication is even more than it ever was before. Because before, they would look at wrestlers that had blemishes on their record, because that's what wrestlers were in the 80s and 90s. But now, as it gets more towards 2023, 2024, and it's going in that direction, they, the reason they're taking so many athletes from other sports and training to wrestle is, number one, they've already showed dedication and commitment. They've played some type of college sport. They spent, you know, graduated high school, spent 4 years in college doing this. So they know, obviously, if they're on scholarship or if they're playing for a sports team in college, they don't have a bad record. So that's why they're taking these people, because 99% of those people qualify to go to that next level of wrestling. They just got to be taught how to wrestle. But if you know how to wrestle and you're in great shape and everything else, but you've got criminal history, you're not going to get in anymore. So you've really got to commit yourself to living a drug-free, alcohol-free lifestyle, physically fit, train yourself, get in incredible shape, and make your run at it. And if it doesn't work out, you got the rest of your life to do whatever you want to do. But don't misconstrue the idea that you can go out and get in trouble when you're 18, 19, or 20 years old and then buckle down at 20 and by 25 have a contract, because it's not going to happen anymore.
For sure.
So my and then, advice would just live straight.
Excuse me. So for sure. And then what schools would you like to suggest for people?
Well, you know, I still think the Monster Factory is a good choice in Jersey. I think Santino Brothers out in California. I think in Florida, you know, you can find a good school in Florida. You go to Pablo Marquez's school in Florida. I think there's good schools all over the place. You've got to look, and you got to look. The best thing you can do is research two things, right? Number one, the guys that I trained that made it, like Otto Schwantz, who had a ECW and a WWE deal, and Joey Matthews and Christian York, who had WCW, ECW, and then WWE contracts, guys like that. You know, it's if you're going to go to school, make sure whoever's running the school or training people has got people into the big shows before, or make sure the school has gotten people into big shows. Like Danny Cage didn't make it to the big show, but his school, the Monster Factory, has put a lot of people into the big show. So if you're going to go down to South Carolina and train with a guy who in his entire life experience, he's wrestled every other Saturday night in South Carolina for 20 years, that's what he's going to be able to teach you to do. If you don't go to school that has put people in WCW, ECW, WWE, AEW, places like that, they're going to have a tough time getting you trained for that because they themselves haven't been there, right? And it's, you know, look, I spent about 4 years in WWF, and I can tell you that when you get up there, it's very intimidating no matter how long you've been in the business. And when you get up there, you've got to perform because there's 1,000 eyes on you every time you go up there.
For sure.
So
I was trying to find somebody
who's been there.
Definitely. And then, so you're retired. Do you have anything else coming up?
Oh, I'm not retired.
Oh, okay.
I never used retired. I never used that word because I always said, and I had this long conversation with Danny and Wayne about it about 2 years ago. I said, look, every time somebody says they're retired, and like one of my biggest heroes, Terry Funk, even used the retired but came out of retirement, right? So
yeah.
I never want to use an R word. I may not be as active as I once was. I'll be doing a show this fall. It's a benefit show. It's going to be in Fayetteville, North Carolina, Hope Mills. And so, you know, but look, you can get up with me at The Real Cue Ball Carmichael at Twitter. You can get up with me on Instagram, The Real Cue Ball Carmichael. You can get up with me on Facebook, Cue Ball Carmichael. Anywhere you want to look for Cue Ball Carmichael, The Real Cue Ball Carmichael, you'll find me. Reach out to me. If I can help you in any way, let me know. I still get a lot of people asking for help in the business, and I'm always glad to give them what intelligent advice that I can give them. And sometimes that advice is, I can't really give you any advice on that because I don't know what I don't know. Never been to that situation. But if I can help you or point you in the direction of somebody that can help you, I'll be glad to.
Definitely. And, yes, I'm really grateful that I follow you on a lot of those social medias where I'm able to see the insight and the suggestions you have for people. Man, thank you so much for everything you do for wrestling, and I wish you all the luck in the world. Thank you so much, buddy.
Okay. Coach Mike, you know I'm a big fan of yours too, man. You know that.
Yes, I appreciate that. And is there anything else you'd like to plug or promote?
No, that's it right now. Just reach out to me. Twitter's a good place to get me. So is Instagram. The Real Cue Ball Carmichael. Just in case there's a fake one.
Thank you so much.
All right, Mike. It was
thank
great
you
talking
so much.
To you, man. Take care.
All right, have a good one.
Bye.
See ya. All right, there he is, Cue Ball Carmichael. Man, been following him for many years. And, really grateful to have him on today. Thanks to Sign Guy for his time. You guys can check me out at Coach Mike Jones, the coach with the most. Coach Mike Jones on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter. Don't forget to check out the Real School Army and the NGW Green Room for hundreds of interviews from celebrities all over the world. And we do have people booked next week. I got Moondog Manson on the 13th. Then on the 20th of May, I got Feel Good. And on the 27th of May, I got Emily and John Wasaka. Excited to talk to them again. And on June 3rd, I got the Northwest Own Chef, Mean Mark. So, yes, looking forward to those. We thank you guys so much for all your love and support and hope you guys give us and for the questions you guys put in and just all the feedback. We thank you so much. We love you, and we appreciate it, and have a good one.
That's right, everybody. You know who it is. Coach Mike Jones on the coach with the most coming.
coming at you hard from coast to coast. I don't wanna boast, but now I gotta roast you in my social media posts. You double dose, a diagnose. You feeling tired, life expired, now you're a ghost. I'll be your host, so won't you raise a toast to the coach with the most, Coach Mike Jones.